Name, Jason Horsley. Profession, Liminalist. This is The Liminalist, the podcast in between. You are now listening. You can walk an island way and you work all the dough and dust. Your eyes were staring at me while playing your guitar.
I came walking a long way, just for another chap. And then I saw her in the crowd and I looked her in the eyes.
I appreciate you doing this last minute because you're my backup, you're my random dude.
Yes, of course. Yeah, I know, but no, it's great to because there's definitely a lot more to talk about. Is there anything that you wanted to bring up from when I was talking to you before? Because I've got a list of things here, but you know.
Oh, really? Well, the only thing, and it's a big thing, I think, is that towards the end of our last conversation, you started going into stuff that interests you around Quakerism, your own background, communism, just the general sort of threads running between different religions and political beliefs, and it was just scratching the surface of something, it felt like to me. So I'm sure that's a very large area to get into, maybe, and maybe if we start that, we'll just go all the way into that. I don't know, but that's certainly the thing that's stands out most to me, is that we didn't really go into that.
Yeah, well, hopefully we can talk about that a little bit. I mean, I don't know a ton about Quakerism. I've never been to a Quaker meeting, which my brother and dad have started going to, strangely. I have some ebooks on my computer about George Fox and stuff like that, but I haven't actually read them yet. But from what I gathered, like, I've read some stuff by Jakob Boehme. Do you know about him?
No.
Well, he's the 16th century hermetist Christian prophet from Germany. And I gather some of his ideas were influential on religions like Quakerism. And I mean, I know in Quakerism they say there's a bit of God in everyone, which is a lot like this hermetist or sort of occultist thing. And also, it's from what I gather, isn't it true that Quakerism really believes that people are very, very good, and that you've suggested in some of your writing that a religion like that really is suppressing the darker side of human nature?
I don't know if I suggest that about Quakerism, and I don't know enough about it, although, ironically, I mean, I come from it to some extent. As you know, my grandfather and my uncle, who's still alive, is a Quaker, and I did ask him about it last time I saw him. He didn't reveal very much that they don't have formal hierarchies, and they don't have formal kind of prayer meetings. It's all very, I think one of the things is that they just get together and sit and wait and see what comes up, which,
yes,
if that's right, that's the same thing that John DeRuyter, that spiritual teacher that I followed in Canada for a while, that was how he began his ministry, interesting enough, was in that style, presumably unrelated to Quakerism, but not based on, you know, overtly on Quakerism. It may just be a kind of...
I heard there were some settlements or early, like long before the American Revolution, where there were communities in America that were like political Quaker communities where like all property was owned communally and stuff like that.
Right.
Some people say this is a sort of a, you know, radical thing at the beginning of America and stuff like that. It's just all interesting to me because I know there's this influence, like that idea that something that says, oh, people are really, really just great, really suppresses what might be dark in them. I mean, it's sort of like the flip side of a, you know, a very Puritan thing that says, oh, well, people are very wicked.
Mm-hmm.
But,
well, that's a whole area to go into. I was talking about this just yesterday, actually, this idea that people are good. And what I said yesterday to my wife was that the only terms or the definition by which somebody could be considered good would be in relation to a group. And so if a person more or less adheres to the what's agreed upon in the group, and if their identity is perfectly aligned with the group and the values of the group, then they can be considered good. But actually, The opposite is true, I would say, that the only way a person could really be considered good in any meaningful sense is if they were completely unaligned with any group identity, and they just had an identity that had no, that didn't depend on the group to define it in any way, and that would be impossible. So, and that's, not necessarily quote the Bible as this great source, but occasionally I do think that the things that were attributed to Jesus are pretty good, and one of them was, "Why do you call me good? None but the Father is good." So if even Jesus said, "Hey, I'm not good," then he's saying that nobody is good, and I think that that's essentially true. I mean, the whole idea of goodness is a social construct, really, unless we just say it's absolutely purely natural and spontaneous, and like the birds and the bees, and well.
Oh, it's very interesting because, I mean, with these figures that you and some other researchers have been talking about, like Bob Dylan or Leonard Cohen, I guess those are sort of like baby boomers icons of like, oh, here's a good guy, you know. But I mean, you had a good takedown of what that there was something kind of phony about those characters. I mean, they're not really like current icons anymore, but I think they have a large, like, I mean, when I was a kid, my parents weren't even baby boomers, they're younger than that, but they would listen to people like Leonard Cohen or Bob Dylan, and it was just sort of like, well, these are these wise old guys that there's something to them. There's like a meaning there, but it was never really clear what the meaning was, you know? Other than oh yeah, just I mean, even with like Plato saying there needs to be this whole process of initiation before people can see what's good. There's also the whole thing with secret societies, intelligence agencies, whatever you want to call it, where that whole belief in group goodness, I mean, it's always sort of gets its coherence from people doing other stuff and side. And I mean, it wouldn't really be secret stuff if it didn't have that exoteric outside, and there wouldn't really be that coherent. Just by making the coherent group narrative, you're bound to suppress and create this subterranean world.
Well, that's interesting. I think that they depend on each other. This is another thing that came up yesterday, is the archetype of Jekyll and Hyde. I think is a really, I mean, you need to say it's a very profound one. It's an archetype, but and it's made it into the popular culture, and we just have it as this kind of this fairy tale idea. But I think it's not really recognized how maybe that is how these things work, is that, well, first of all, like if you're in a, the main thing I think for human beings, for socialized human beings, is to feel safe within the group and to be accepted by the group and not to risk rejection. So that's what I was saying earlier. The idea of being good is basically the idea of being approved of, or of adhering to the approved ways of being. That's goodness, and that's what makes a person feel safe. So if you imagine a person who is gradually introduced to a way of being in a moral code, or whatever you want to call it, that is the opposite of what that person has accepted, they will, the safest thing is to go along with that inverted way of being. So they might naturally just adapt their behaviors over time until they were doing things they would never imagine themselves doing. Because not only because it's safe to do them, so then that id part of them can begin to express, the high can emerge, but that it's unsafe not to. It actually would feel wrong to go against the group, because there's just this basic instinct in us, which is to fit in with the group, and that I think is the primary drive, or at least one of them.
That's one of the things. I think I definitely have seen the dynamic you're talking about, but I think there's this counter dynamic of, rebellion or sort of like initiation through these tests.
And so this is what I was saying, that they go together,
Oh,
because
yeah.
a person who's the part of the general, mainstream society, but that doesn't allow expression for the id, and it doesn't allow individuation. So there's this counter running urge to individuate and to express the id. Not that they're the same thing, but you can't individuate without having a safe space to express your id within. So then as they're drawn into these other constructs or ideologies, the secret societies or what have you, the pedophile rings, whatever it is, then that provides an opportunity, a kind of false individuation, because they're actually rebelling against the very society that's conditioned to them, which is a sort of surrogate individuation in itself, the rebellion, that's the individuatory urge. And they're able to do so by aligning themselves with this other group and by committing acts that are considered taboo. Like even myself, I was never a Christian, I was raised an atheist, but I did end up in my 30s performing this Lucifer ritual. I got tattoos, I did a whole ritual anyway, I won't go into the details. And the reason behind it consciously was that I wanted to open myself up to the darkest aspects of existence to show that I could contain all of it. So it was an individuatory thing. I wanted to allow the id to come all the way in and possess me in the form of Lucifer, symbolically Lucifer. But that the reason I fixated on Lucifer was because within a Christian society, that's the worst thing, right? That's the taboo. So even though I wasn't a Christian, I was still drawn to that kind of shadow enactment. So you can imagine somebody who was raised a Christian that has these values really deeply embedded, how much further they would go in terms of trying to get free of the dominant culture.
Absolutely. And I mean, that just you saying that made me think that, all this research, all this delving, questioning, and stuff that I've done almost is a little bit of a thing where I think it might be echoes of that kind of, there's this, this push to integrate everything. You see that in Hermetism and stuff. And, it's like this whole thing of like, oh, I have to find out where I come from, what the civilization I come from is based on, so that I can figure out who I am. This whole thing of conspiracy theory or all this research into high weirdness and stuff. It's like you were just saying individuation and false differentiation. And I know you've written stuff about differentiation from the mother and father, and it's kind of inevitable that there's a parallel there. Sort of like what we're doing now, this conversation we're having, we're trying to figure out some stuff, no doubt. And there's, I guess, this whole thing where you're trying to push yourself outside of where you came from, but you're unable to leave. And then with some of these, with some of the more extreme people out there, like far right people and stuff, they have this whole story of we will become the new leaders of society by putting ourselves in conflict with the current leaders. So I guess like that whole war of the generations and ancient myths and stuff, actually. But I mean, that sort of like creative conflict process is also what's going on with, all these institutions like jails and mental hospitals and stuff. I mean, like whatever drama is being enacted between, all these psychiatrists that are sometimes like torturing, but I guess more regularly just, disciplining all these patients and stuff, sort of like a microcosm of the bigger struggle to, affirm this conflict-based, creation, reproduction of a civilization or whatever.
Can you do unpack that a bit?
Yeah, well, I mean, like, I guess, sorry, I jumped through a couple things there, but I think there's no question that, people are identified as mentally ill, and, they're in those liminal spaces, like psychiatric hospitals or something like that. I mean, there's obviously a meaning there, like a really powerful meaning to it, because, those people that were working in them, like the doctors and stuff, they're dealing with a very wide range of different people going through a lot of different things. So I guess what ties it all together is the fact that it's, an embodiment of this conflict of, I mean, you talk so much about like neurodiversity and all this stuff, and I mean, the conflict that's going on there seems to be like a conflict of like, well, we're going to redeem these people by proving that they're different. And also, I mean, I'm not sure if the real project is to redeem the people that are supposedly mentally ill and make them normal. I mean, I don't think that's a good thing anyways.
Well, they're
That's the
right.
real purpose of those institutions. But I mean, that's like their overt purpose, right?
Well, possibly, yeah, their overt purpose, yeah. So this is interesting. I mean, well, first of all, the conflict, I don't know if it's the conflict you're talking about exactly because it's amorphous, but the conflict that I'm getting that you're touching on seems to be the conflict between the group mind and the individual. So essentially, if you're talking about a mental institution, that represents the society, that represents the consensus view of what's real and what's meaningful and what has value and etc. And then you're talking about all these diverse types that end up there, who they're diagnosed and they're branded with all these different diagnoses, but essentially it's just one diagnosis, which is reject or anomaly, whatever, as in that they need to be corrected so that they will then be compatible with the group,
And then with all this
with the
stuff,
collective,
or I
yeah.
guess at the more extreme end of it, you'd have stuff like MK Ultra. All those people have
Exactly,
been
yeah.
identified as differentiating in a way that can't be contained and needs to be contained. They all become a catalyst for the evolution of this sort of, for this sort of, this sort of machine that really is, when I see this whole, all-encompassing machine, like DARPA, all their technologies to sort of control everything and stuff. I mean, there's a little bit of that whole hermetic thing there, right? Of like, go to everywhere, go to every place, contain everything, dig up everything.
So what do you mean when you use the word hermetic?
Well, I mean, I'm just talking about even like the hermetic books and the whole hermetic tradition.
A tradition, right?
The whole thing seems to be saying, the magician must contain all things and learn about all things and contain all things within himself, which is sort of like a
Right. So that's the hermetically sealed thing, a container, and then the hermetic and hermit, I presume, are related as words.
and it just makes me think of this very, this whole drama of that society that needs to control and integrate everything, and then like that's just that hermetic sort of journey or whatever you want to call it, but going on a group or like a civilization level. And now we've segued pretty nicely because we've been talking about mental hospital stuff, and this brings us right into mind control and all the stuff you've been talking to people like Ed Diamond about.
Yeah, well, that's what was also where I was interested that this could go. Because, I mean, for example, Jimmy Savile, he had the keys to Broadmoor, so he basically had access to a mental hospital, one of the most famous and reputed or whatever, reputable. Where Reggie Cray of the Cray Twins, for example, was there. I mean, I don't know who other perhaps famous criminals, but also a lot of just young girls who were runaways or rebels or anyway, he had predatory access there as Jimmy Savile. But what hasn't been speculated on, I don't think, as far as I know, and even I hadn't thought about it until recently, was that maybe Jimmy Savile was let into Broadmoor, not just as a predator to be able to, satisfy his base urges, but as a handler who was part of a MK Ultra style program.
The impression I get is that someone like, well, Savile, I mean, not to go over to Savile, there's a lot been said about Savile. It's obviously he's at the center of a lot of this stuff. But the biggest question for me with Savile is what's the purpose of the whole outing, post-mortem outing of MB? I mean, it's a polymanifolded thing. I've heard people suggest that it was Rupert Murdoch's newspapers that first published some of this stuff in the real mainstream. And then that immediately makes me distrust. I mean, I'm glad that there's been some kind of exposure of it, but on the other hand, it makes me think that there's perhaps a bit of a nefarious purpose to some of the bombardment with it,
Can you think what that would be?
Well, a couple different things. I mean, one would just be further blackmail, which is what I thought about Rob Ford in Canada, the very, obviously they're getting this mayor of Toronto in trouble for smoking crack and all this stuff that's really embarrassing and disgraceful, but very minor compared to what no doubt a lot of these players are involved in. And it just seemed like a sort of a blackmail, it's endless public humiliation of them. It seemed like, well, this is what's going to happen to you if you don't toe the line. You're saying that to everyone else in the system. And with the Savile thing, I mean, you've talked about an agenda of normalizing, child abuse, really, which, people call pedophilia, but I don't know if I even like that term because it means child love, and there's obviously something very hurtful and abusive going on here, right? So, whether there's a thing of normalizing it, there's a thing of, the way I grew up is so, it so much was a product of this whole machine and the civilization, but it was also so far removed from all this really dramatic and dark stuff that for me to learn about it, it's like, okay, the people that are really at the in the center of it must have some really different belief systems themselves, if they're even aware of what they're doing, or they're not just completely dissociated. And I can see them saying, well, maybe we want to educate everyone about what we've been doing. Or I mean, even like the whole presidency of George W. Bush or something like that seemed like a sort of humiliation for America, right? And then for the UK, this whole thing about Jimmy Savile, it's like, okay, we've taken, I get the sense no one really did think Jimmy Savile was a wholesome person, but at
Yeah,
least
that's what it's like now, isn't it?
there was at least, it seems like he was an icon of this forced, cheery, not really pleasant, but kind of like, I don't know, this sort of forcible, good manners of like charity and stuff like that in a really kind of nasty way, but of course not nearly as nasty as what he really was.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I think that's one thing that might seem minor, but it may be not minor, is that it's easy to believe the stories about him now that they've come out, and people have been saying, oh, well, I always knew it, or I always suspected, or there was always something a bit off about him. Because of his manners was very crass and crude and lewd and lascivious and all the rest of it. And so it to some extent reinforces this idea that these sexual predators and sociopaths that walk among us, they may be able to disguise themselves, but not that well, right? They're not going to be able to disguise themselves as nice, kind, considerate, warm people. And I think that's false. I think that they can disguise themselves that way. Or and maybe it's not even a disguise, to bring it back to this Jekyll and Hyde thing. I think that something is going on in our society that isn't being seen, and the revelations are maybe even preventing it from being seen in some way, rather than letting us see the real truth, which is that this split is in all of us, to one degree and another, and that those who've kind of accentuated the split have maybe created this kind of Jekyll and Hyde existence where they can actually be very nice, warm, seemingly considerate and kind community people, while behind the scenes they express this completely opposite side, and in a way that the two sides depend on each
Yeah, I
other.
mean, the community needs that to function, which is a lot of what I think people like Georges Bataille are almost writing about that stuff very directly a long time ago. They're saying that we need this kind of, theatrical sadomasochistic sacrifice and everything like that. I don't know if I'm a big fan of the way someone like him would be writing about it, because he seems like he's almost really into it and not trying to heal from it or anything, but maybe he's just honest. I don't know. But I think another thing with all this stuff, I mean, you're po making these posts about this Hampstead thing that I haven't even looked into really. But there's a, even with earlier stuff, but with all this stuff, there's this whole context of like psychological warfare, and I think I saw somebody use the phrase of like epistemic disorientation, where you put enough crazy stuff out there about, similar to like 9/11 or the JFK assassination, where you just flood people with so many narratives that it becomes impossible to talk about the subject. And I noticed that this polarization that was going on with this one person you're talking to on that forum, Rigorous Intuition, where you're saying, I don't know all the details of this case, but there's absolutely no way I'm willing to dismiss it. And then he was painting you into a corner as being, well, you're a true believer. You think you know what happened. And it's you either see the truth, which is that these people are crazy and liars, or else you're part of the true believers. You could just accuse anyone and ruin anyone's life.
Yeah, the witch hunt meme,
And that whole false polarization, I mean, like, I know that relates again to stuff you were talking about before with, where liminality breaks down into.
exactly, yeah. And I think that's probably maybe the most interesting or far-reaching agenda that may be being played out here, is destabilization to accentuate liminality, chaos, disorder. And if you think about it, okay, 9/11, JFK, sure, those things are disturbing to people and they're profoundly triggering. They were, no doubt about it, but they're not, I don't think they can compare to the kind of trigger if somebody or a whole country, people, a whole nation of people have profound trauma in their childhood. some form of abuse, however subtle or however profound, different spectrum of abuse, being triggered by these revelations, reacting against that, trying to push down whatever it is that's in their awareness that's so threatening. That kind of destabilization, at an individual level, and then at a collective level. I mean, obviously, if all the institutions are being exposed in Britain one by one, and even the Prime Minister right now is, this whole thing with the pig's head. I don't know if you heard about that. It's, I mean, really like the level of destabilization, both at a personal and a collective level. That can only have caused this extreme polarization. I mean, among other things, I think there's all kinds of.
There's also a thing with certain societies that maybe later on in the Roman Empire or even in somewhere like Saudi Arabia today, where I think everyone knows that there's this kind of decadence and statism and corruption going on, and that's part of the mechanism that's used to put ter instill terror into people. And I think that must be going on in Britain right now too. And I just wanted to, I mean, when you're talking about destabilization, there's also people who write about that very directly. I don't know if you've ever heard of, like, I'm sure you've heard of all the stuff about fourth generation warfare, as it's called. People like, that guy John Robb, or all these right wing people in the United States saying,
I don't know about that now.
all these people in the United States, right wing people in the United States. I mean, I think that guy from Reverse Intuition, Justin Boland, or Wombaticus Rex, has referred to them a lot, saying, they're saying, okay, we're losing this culture war. The only way we can ever reconstitute ourselves is by destroying all the institutions and by attacking all the points. I mean, they're like conservatives or libertarians, Christians. Like, they're basically American right wingers, but they're saying, oh, we need to adopt the strategies of groups like Al Qaeda or Islamic State in the East and use those in North America. And I think with a lot of these random shootings and stuff in the United States, they're definitely in that spectrum. And I mean, these are very extreme people saying, they're the kind of people who'd say somebody like Anders Behring Breivik is somebody they'd be emulating, you know? But
I don't know who that
he
is.
has that guy who killed all the children at that socialist camp in Norway.
Yeah. Who was supposedly neurodivergent?
Yeah, and it seems like in America there's this whole community of people who openly talk this way, right, on the extreme right. And they're openly talking about destabilization. And then you have the other coin of it with, there's all this stuff in, academic institutions where it's more to the left, I guess you could call it. But it's going back to this whole thing. I mean, Marx, like, I'm studying Hegel in university right now. It's very much in the Hermetic tradition of, include everything into your system. I know Marx came out of Hegel, and a lot of the stuff of, dialectics and, I mean, they're not so much trying to destabilize, they're more trying to create like an all-encompassing institution. But like we were saying before, when we were talking about how that conflict and individuation is part of the way the system reproduces itself, I think these fascists, extreme right people, and those institutional, people are two hands of the same entity almost.
Sure.
Definitely, when you look at the government. And sorry, maybe I'm taking too simplistic a thought.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know enough of the material, but in a way, I mean, I tend to oversimplify, I know, but I think it's, if anything, better than over complexifying, because it's all too easy to get overwhelmed by all the stuff. And
Information.
so, what's occurring to me, again, to simplify, is that if you think of, in simple terms, of the left-right dichotomy, which itself is oversimplified, isn't it about collectivism versus individualism?
Yeah, I guess I was just commenting on how extreme the right is getting. I mean, the left is getting extreme in a different way.
Yeah. Well, I was bringing it back to the other conflict, which is the group versus the individual. So that's that again, no? And so I mean, the extreme right winger might not identify him or herself as a right winger at all. But there's that Ayn Randian thing, which is almost like it transcends, or at least pretends to or aspires to transcend political belief and to enter into, I guess you'd say, spiritual, or I don't even know what word you would give to the Ayn Randianism, but that elevation of the idea of the individual to a kind of sacred pinnacle.
I think the reason I went down that avenue is because I was talking about people who are openly talking about the kind of destabilization agenda. They're openly owning up to it. And then this whole spectacle of Islamic State, too, regardless how much of that is real or not, I mean, that's not an individualist one, but it has that same dynamic going on of, you know, extreme destabilization followed by extremely rigid order. And I think you can see that even in the zeitgeist of people who are interested in things like social justice. I'm not trying to compare or equivocate between those two, but there's a similar sort of thing where it's like, okay, we're going to create a swarm of different narratives and chaos and then have the pendulum swing back to a kind of a rigid thing. And another thing I want to bring up, because I know you were chatting with this one woman about feminism and all these topics like, all these ideas about, you know, sex workers and stuff like that. That was a really interesting podcast. One thing I've picked up on is this swing from, you know, this hypersexual thing with like third wave feminism and stuff like that, into now there's this huge trend calling almost everyone asexual and stuff like that. Is that something you're aware of?
I wasn't aware of that specific thing, the asexual thing.
Well, there's this whole idea now among a lot of teenagers, especially, of an asexual spectrum, where basically they say if you ever feel that you don't want to have sex with someone, that puts you on the asexual spectrum. So it's sort of like an inverted mirror of like some of the hypersexual stuff that you were talking about with that one.
Well, something came up at the Rigorous Intuition thread. I don't know if you read that one about the Salon.com article of the Todd Nickerson, you know, who's this pedophile, supposedly non-practicing pedophile. Did you read that?
Oh, yeah. Like, I mean, I'm really fascinated by all this stuff because I...
Well, I mentioned it because in the context of what you're saying, because something came up there, post of Project Willow, who's... Lynn Sherman, I think her name is, who's a survivor. She posted about transsexuals and how, I don't want to quote because this is paraphrasing and I might distort it, but the idea anyway was to do with how men are now claiming the power of women in a sense and stealing the voice of women, because men who can turn themselves into women, then actual natural biological women are being pushed out of the debate and even sort of bullied out of the debate. So it's kind of as though men, transsexualism, because it can't be questioned, like within the context of political correctness and sexual tolerance and lifestyle tolerance and all the rest of it. If you're a transsexual, if you have a gender change to a woman, you have to be recognized as a woman. Then, like as much of a woman as a biologically born woman, and if anyone suggests otherwise, then that's a kind of prejudice against transgenderism.
Right, and this is something because of my age. I mean, I'm 27, right? I've been going to university for a couple of years now. I've been living in places like Toronto and Montreal, and I feel like this whole thing of trans politics has really been like, for people that are in these cosmopolitan centers, this has been like the central political issue, it almost feels like, a lot of the time. And it's constantly being rephrased and reformulated. And there's sort of purges against anyone who isn't up to date. Like, I guess what's called queer... I mean, from what I understand, the term of, like, queer community or something started in the 1990s as a thing to say. Now we're back to this whole thing of multiplicity that then collapses into, rigidity, right? Because my understanding is the whole idea of queer community started with this thing of saying, oh, let's include everyone who doesn't fit into these rigid categories, et cetera, et cetera. And then, of course, it collapsed into this thing of, like, you know, purging everyone who doesn't have the correct idea about what queer is.
So this is interesting in the context of what we were talking about earlier about the mental institutions, because it's as if society is moving towards a kind of inversion of this where... what was once considered a mental disorder and you would have to be corrected for it is now, it's almost like the inversion of that, that is now being celebrated and put forward as a new lifestyle. And if you question it or suggest it's a pathology, then you yourself need to be criminalized and pathologized.
Yeah, well, I think these things like social sciences are sort of a laboratory where everyone is being evaluated and graded on their performance, and they're all, it's sort of like, I mean, when we're talking about stuff like queer politics, we're talking about a lot of stuff that's going on in universities, and a lot of it is going on with a lot of money coming from a lot of these sort of think tanks and things. So the people involved in it may indeed have come from, they may have grown up in a context where they're very marginalized. They may have not been able to express all these feelings, but once it gets integrated into this institutional thing, then they become kind of this hegemonic power. So it's kind of like a, they feel like they're redeeming some lack of power they may have or may not have had at one time by then saying, okay, now we're gonna create these rules. And I think that the system that's integrating and dispersing all these different narratives has gotten so sophisticated that it's there's they're using, they see all these conflicts about things like feminism and gender politics almost probably as a, as another arena in which to sort of create divisions between people, create unions between people. And when you read about, like, I'm sure you've heard about people like Cass Sunstein and all these people, they're saying behavioral scientists, right? And the fact that sometimes they're often tied into these think tanks that are the kind of things that give funding to social sciences and political movements or to groups that are involved in things like color revolutions, you know. And this is just like, it's just really weird because then this gets into this whole thing of like, well, what is the West about? What is liberalism about? Because it seems to be about this sort of like laboratory for social change, which goes back to all the stuff you were talking about, occult Yorkshire, weird shit going on in places like Britain in the 20th century. Maybe this stuff has always been going on throughout civilization. It's certainly in a very sophisticated form. Sorry if I'm rambling a bit and tying a whole bunch of things together. We can unpack it in a minute. But what's interesting is that this power block in the world of the West or whichever you want to call it. I mean, there's this one formation manifestation that it has where it has this very, you know, like, well, very much like, you know, sexual liberation, try, you know, do everything, try everything, go against traditions. And then it has this other manifestation with, like, you know, Saudi Arabia, very much allied, Gulf states, ultra conservative, American Christian fundamentalists, ultra conservative, you know. So maybe like the far right, place like Israel too, and those groups are very much part of the same power block as that super, you know, permissive, super radical thing that's for radical social change, and I find that very paradoxical and interesting.
Sure. Well, isn't it a pendulum like you were talking about before? It seems like, when you're talking about social engineering, or at least when you start to look into it and discover evidence suggesting that, just how complex it is and how far-reaching, how widespread, how consistent, and how long it's been going on, then it becomes by definition impossible to really get one's head around, fully map it, fully understand how these things could possibly be.
Desire to fully map it is like exactly the desire that's at the heart of that's manifestation is this big system.
Well, that's an interesting point, I guess. So then we end up mirroring the thing that we're
Oh, absolutely.
trying to understand, which can be a valid way to understand it, of course. But so this is what I was trying to get to a moment ago, which is that I think, and this has been my approach anyway, that although it's incredibly complex, it's also very, very simple if it's essentially based on rule, kind of unchanging rules or laws of the psyche and of biology. And one of them that's occurring to me as you were talking is the principle of the abused who becomes the abuser, the victim who becomes the victimizer. It seems that that's just a really fundamental principle. It's probably in the Bible, all through the Bible, if you look for it. And we see it in turn. I mean, recently in transgenderism, once upon a time they were the victims, and now it seems that transgenderism is becoming this kind of movement that's very intolerant of not just anyone who's intolerant of it, but even of biological women who claim to have more of an understanding of what being a woman is than they do, which obviously is factually true,
Maybe
but
that's a little bit
it's.
of an exaggeration, but there's no question that there's very, very like much ideological purges and total like restatements of this whole thing with gender politics, it's like, you know, I've been reading about it for the past 10 years or so. So I've noticed that every couple of years, there's just a whole restatement of what the correct belief is, and everyone has to fall in line with the new thing. And then you get the whole
Right.
question of what's at the center of that restatement. And I think when you do enough research into the 20th century, you can find these places like, you know, the Anglo, you know, English upper class and stuff, where there was this sort of like they were at the center of some of these restatements of political things, and they were just these very hyper powerful people, it seems.
Okay, so when we're talking about social engineering, one of the things that, you know, skeptics roll their eyes at with conspiracy theories is because it seems impossible that, you know, just one group or what have you could possibly have this much control. But one of the basic premises of social engineering is that although the power appears to keep shifting and moving, it's not. It's basically being directed from a consistent position. Right. So the same agendas are continuing throughout the centuries, across the nations, throughout different ideologies. It's the same basic agenda. Now, I happen to think that this is true, but I also think that the conspiracy theory, even if it hadn't been so debased, you know, by conspiratainment and all the rest of it, and the well poisoning, was always insufficient, because this isn't about individual conspiracies so much as an underlying principle.
Oh, absolutely.
That's being understood and applied. And so, again, because I didn't finish this point about abuse and abuse, that this seems to be how this seems to be a mechanism that is constantly being employed, that a group is subject is persecuted, is victimized, is demonized, is ostracized, all the rest of it. We've got the Jews, you've got the transgenders, you know, take your pick. But then so there's a period there in which whatever kind of political regime is pushing forward and persecuting a group in order to do so. And then there's a shift over, so the end of World War II, the creation of Israel, and then the persecuted become the persecutors.
Yeah,
And so the balance of power shifts, but basically the same dynamic is going on. So it's like this pendulum that's moving from right to left, to right to left, to left to right, and it just keeps moving forward, because that momentum keeps that it's like the power base, or whatever you want to call it, that's engineering this, is at the very center of that axis, right, or that seesaw. I can't think what the exact term it
you're
is,
talking
but it.
about the far right, and when the far right says we want to create a new elite by going to war with the current elite, that's part of how the system works. You're talking
Right.
about people like the Nazis thinking they were going to overthrow the West, but really they were being funded by all these people like the British upper class and stuff like that, or the
Sure.
Habsburgs or something like that, and really they were just a tool. I mean, obviously the Nazis were did all this really horrible, horrible stuff. But I mean, they weren't even consistent with their own idea of what they were. They weren't rebels, really. I mean, they were just like creating an excess of the worst of, you know, the things that had gone on before, right? But when you're saying, oh, I believe that this power has remained concentrated over millennia, and not so much in a specific group of people, but in more of a principle. It sounds like you're talking maybe a bit about the principle of like royalty, royal sovereignty, and things like that. Is that sort of what you're getting at there?
I don't know, actually. Do you want to say more?
Because like one idea that I've heard that I think is, I mean, like there's this whole idea of like the sovereign is the person who does everything, that whether it's like the high priest, Roman emperor, you know, kings, whatever. They're the person who does everything that's forbidden to everyone else, you know.
Right.
Which is again, but now we're back to again to all this far right stuff, right? Tantric spirituality from India, and you know, you have all these fascists who are interested in people like Julius Evola, who again, you were talking about people who transparently say we want to destabilize the system, and then you transparently have people with those fascist writers saying break every taboo. I mean, Aleister Crowley again, right? Break every taboo, or Sabbatai Zevi, who wasn't necessarily a right-wing person, but he was definitely a revolutionary, right, in the early modern times. And he was saying, you know, break every rule, and or Blake, William Blake, right? Break every taboo, and you know, it'll create this rebirth of society. I mean, they're stating it very blatantly, right?
Did Blake state that as well?
Well, and maybe less of a violent way, but I mean, it certainly sounds like he's saying, you know, you have to go down
Well, there's a sort of paradox there because, I mean, as I said, in my own experience, there is definitely some truth in this, is that you identify the taboos or instinctively you recognize them and then you test them out and you go against them in ways to, as a form of individuation, not as a rebellion against the group, but as a way to discover one's own autonomy from it by allowing oneself to express the forbidden things and so clearing out those fears, right?
That's what's constituted the group in the first place, and that's what's given it.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, so there's a paradox here because if you do go against all the taboos and you get rid of taboos, well then what's left, right? What's left to define you?
Well, I think that then you, I mean, like with a person like Saville, I mean, let's assume that maybe not for the entire population, but for a good number of people who are in the know. They knew Saville was this figure who broke all taboos, and it meant that they could. It's like we don't have to worry about it. It's similar to how we have, you know, it's like we can live all these lives we call peaceful because we have this different military industrial complex that lets us live in this materially abundant society and have this relatively comfortable existence. So we can say, oh, we're all peaceful people. And meanwhile, some this sort of sovereign power is taking care of all the stuff that's beyond that limit, that's in that beyond that liminal boundary of, you know, do you know what I'm saying?
Well, I could certainly apply it to my own situation, which is that on the one hand, what I discover about the world and have discovered convinces me that there's something very profoundly wrong. But on the other hand, the lifestyle that I have is the lifestyle that I want. I wouldn't want to have to live in a community, an intentional community like Bennett Freeman was trying to, propagate, and I wouldn't want to live in the wilderness like an animal. So essentially, I'm grateful to the system that I recognize as corrupt beyond all redeeming. So all I can say from that is that this is my opportunity to individuate within my own space, within my own hermetic space, I suppose, without being without turning a blind eye to what's going on, actually. Allowing it to inform my own understanding of myself, which is why I've always had difficulty talking about these things, but lately, rigorous intuition is that no, you can't talk about paedophiles and you can't talk about sociopaths and you can't talk about all these things as if they are something outside of oneself. It simply doesn't, not only is it not
It's
true, but
healthy.
it
It's healthy to not say we're all exactly the same. It's healthy to say, okay, you know, I'm not abusing people. Like,
Yes, but those are just facts. They're not that judgments or interpretations you could say, and they may not be facts because we don't know. We don't have a full memory recall.
we
We
know.
could have alters. We could have been mind controlled, and we could have a secret life as abusers. We honestly don't know if we start letting in some of this stuff as possibility, and we certainly don't know what we're capable of.
Keep
So.
obviously to keep sane, we have these ideas that we keep a relative amount of certainty about. I mean, I just think in my own life, I've had, you know, I haven't been involved in abusing anyone or being abused in these extreme ways, but I've certainly had situations in relationships where there was a
Yeah.
breakdown of something and there was a lot of chaos, people having mental breakdowns. And, I mean, when I was a teenager, I was in a psychiatric hospital and I've been in a relationship with people where they got to that point, right, and stuff like that. So I think that's like a that's starting to edge in on that territory, and that's again why, you know, these things like mental hospitals are so central, especially when you're talking about mind control and everything. But the thing that's interesting, sorry if this is going a bit too much into a bit of a like intellectual wanker kind of thing, but I think, you know, well, first of all, there's this whole thing that's regaining influence in the world of like traditionalism, seeing people saying, well, we need to go back to kings, and people saying like in Russia, Vladimir Putin is like this figure of like, you know, this king, you know, like Alexander Dugin, the political theorist that works for Putin, saying, well, we need to go back to these people like René Guénon. Have you heard of René Guénon?
No.
Well, he's this French philosopher who he was associated with people like, or not a philosopher, sorry, he's a French occultist, basically. But associated with people in his youth, like Aleister Crowley, but then where somebody like Crowley was going in much more of a kind of like hyper-liberal direction, saying everyone should do it what they will and all that stuff. Guénon was like super hyper-fascist and conservative, basically. saying, you know, we need the king, we need all this kind of stuff. Now, Poutine's chief theorist or whatever is saying, oh, I'm a disciple of Gounod, Julius Evola, and all these people with that, right? And then, but then, you know, this whole thing that's really interesting in the Enlightenment, right, where like Immanuel Kant was saying, well, everyone should embody the lawmaker in this community, in this universal community where we're all deciding together as things. I think, you know, like the categorical imperative and all that stuff. I mean, like, there's this whole thing that happened in the Middle Ages of the king's two bodies, right? Where the king was a person and human like anyone else, but then he had this other body of the lawmaker that was sort of like superhuman. But then in the Enlightenment, Kant said, well, everyone should be a lawmaker and everyone should have this universal aspect of themselves. And I think
Well, that's
this,
it, yeah.
sorry, I think this can really be related to all this really dark material that you're talking about, because after the Enlightenment, we had this society where we were, you know, things like torture and stuff like that weren't going on the surface anymore. There were people like Quakers working to eliminate them, right? So working to say no more slavery, no more capital, no more corporal punishment, all that kind of stuff. Well, let's stop beating our children and things like that. But at the same time, you had all this stuff like MK Ultra being developed in the shadows, and then, you know, the very in this sort of enlightened society, you know, the ideal sort of subject is going to be somebody who can say, who can justify this exceptional state where things like MK Ultra happen, because it means we get to have a civilized life for everyone else. And they can sort of dissociate very effectively because they can say, well, all of this stuff that the sovereign power is doing to ensure this enlightened egalitarian life for all the rest of it's unknowable, really. It's sort of beyond my ken. It's beyond what I can really make any kind of concrete statement about. Therefore, it would be irresponsible of me to be neurotically trying to deal with it or kind of
Change it.
address it in the way that me and you are trying to talk about it right now. Sorry if that was a
No, that was all very interesting. You know, Eugene Sackham relates to what you were saying. I haven't read him actually, and he didn't come on the podcast, but he talks about how the Enlightenment coincided with the emergence of horror fiction.
Yeah.
You know about that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I know about like how the Romantics were like a counter-Enlightenment, really.
Right, so that's kind of what you're touching on, of course. It's, you know, the Enlightenment is all about how reason can basically direct and sort everything out, and of course, that's simply not true. The id will have its way one way or another. So the more power you give to reason, the more power you're giving to the id, essentially, because the id thrives in the darkness. So that I think is very interesting, and that's what we're touching on all the way through this conversation with the Jekyll and Hyde thing, and this seems to be the principle that's being employed and perhaps exploited, but perhaps we shouldn't assume that we know what the motivations or even the end result is, but certainly that's being employed in order to engineer society towards perhaps some end, or perhaps it's the opposite, perhaps in order that there isn't an end, that it just continues indefinitely in this kind of liminal limbo. That would be my guess, that the Guardian is this has usurped this the power and the principle at the center of everything, and the ego, and all it's trying to do is maintain the chaos in which no one can find the ground, and therefore no one will recognize that this rational interpretation of things is no more accurate a representation than the sort of primal id view that everything is just there to be devoured, right?
Yeah, and I think what you're saying goes beyond the like rational, enlightened sort of thing. It just goes on to like the human condition of like, you know, we're divorced from ourselves and stuff.
Right.
And
But
psychoanalysis, I think that's why like the Freud and psychoanalysis they were talking about, I think even like last time I talked to you, we were talking about like Aeschylus and the Oresteia and stuff like that, and you know, sons killing their mothers and all this kind of stuff. It's very
So yeah, I mean, if you have a basic split or a condition or a disorder, whatever you call it, that isn't recognized, it's going to have a ripple down effect into everything and create a society that reflects that. And then you can have an endless array of problems to fix for all eternity, essentially, because it doesn't matter how many different solutions you come up with. If you haven't addressed the fundamental split, nothing is going to change.
Well, it's going to
So
be fully solved, but that, I mean, we can.
Oh, well, it's not even going to be improved. It will actually get like progressively worse, I
I think
think,
if
because
we make it into a thing, though, of that it is an infinite regress of reenacting trauma or else a complete healing, that's a bit of a polarization. I mean, there's some middle ground there.
Well, I think the middle ground is that both is happening, but it's again the group, the collective versus the individual. I think collectively it just gets worse and worse. Perhaps indefinitely, although you would think that if something was getting worse, it couldn't, there would still be an end point. I guess the species destroys itself or what have you. But anyway, congruent with that, you have individuals within that who are, I don't know what words to use. They are seizing the opportunity. I don't like that. That's kind of, carpe diem and all that crap. It's not about choice or courage or, but something is happening at an individual level. I mean, for let's face it, very few individuals are somehow able to contain this, back to this containment idea, actually to contain all of this awareness as it increases of the distortion and not do anything about it. Just let it be an awareness. And that leads over time to the awareness, the real sort of visceral awareness that the split or the disorder, what have you, is very basic and very simple. And I know that I risk becoming dogmatic here, but and it's words and all that. But the psyche and the body are not, they're not one whole. They've been split in two. And this brings back to the thing you said about the king, which I thought was very interesting. The two sides of the king, you see, and that how everyone needs to be like that. Well, that means everyone has to be split. And this is like John DeRuyter, that what I found with him, he was a king on stage, but he was a jester, but and that's charitable. He was a, an abuser and a liar and a well, anyway, don't get me started on that. But the two sides of him were split. They weren't one whole. So the lawmaker was actually in service to the id. Rationality was in service to the id. Hyde was the slave to, well, Jekyll was the slave of Hyde. I mean, it's a kind of symbiotic slavery, but putting it in easier to understand terms, like the sort of darker, more primal instincts are actually using the seemingly rational or royal facade. Or identity as a cloak and as a means to its own ends.
It's a
And
sick reciprocity there, right? If you're talking about MK Ultra and things like that, is it really a thing of people saying, okay, we're going to justify raping kids and stuff because it's going to lead to some kind of enlightenment about human nature? Or is it really just the fact that they had this kind of abusive drive and then they used that to justify this system that was really just more abuse writ large?
yeah, or is it both? I mean, can it be both? I mean, they can actually believe this, certainly, because we have to believe our own justifications, otherwise they don't work. But it could also be true, in quotes, at the level that they're existing at. I mean, the level that they're capable of perceiving, which is an ego level, this may be the best way, this may appear to be the best way to actually sort society out. And they may be right in terms of if you want to maintain society as it is,
Who does?
I mean,
Who
yeah, well,
does?
who does? I mean, that's a weird thing,
Is
but
a blindness, definitely, because unless there really is some secret gizmo for transhumanism to happen soon, which I don't think there is, there's a blindness going on because if there's something where it's.
well, by definition, that there is a blindness, but it's hard to talk about, isn't it? Because it's like, how do you talk about fragmentation? How do you even recognize it
Let's
if you're
just.
in a, if you're in it, if you're a fragment, if you're just a
Riffs,
fragment?
which I really like. I really like these riffs you've just been saying, but they go right back to that, back to this guy, Jakob Burma, that 16th century German mystic who was one of the influences on Quakerism. I mean, I was reading this text of his, 40 Questions on the Soul, and it just keeps saying, all of existence is shot through with this bit like fragmentation and separation, and that's what constitutes it as a whole. I mean, that's again sounds like a really simple concept from alchemy and all that stuff, but the way he states it is very much like how you're stating it. He's saying that, you can never actually make it whole.
But it already is whole. It doesn't have to be made whole. That's the thing. But the whole system, everything in existence by definition is a whole. So I was thinking about this recently, and even trying to write about it. This whole idea of purity and impurity. It's a weird thing. Like the ego is like this system that has created itself out of elements of the whole. And therefore, it becomes this fortress, and society then reflects that or extends outward. This fortress that considers itself a whole, but is just a collection of fragments that have arranged themselves into a kind of arbitrary, because it's temporary, arrangement. And that means that the possibility of impurity exists, as in anything that isn't compatible with that arbitrary arrangement is seen as impure. So then it becomes a fortress of so-called purity. But actually, if you break apart that whole thing, and I don't mean, by violence or anything, but if it's allowed to dissolve, then those fragments, just like an ice cube in the ocean, they just become part of the whole thing. And then there is no fragmentation, there never was. There's no possible impurity, because there's nothing. How can anything enter into existence that isn't part of existence? It's like, duh. I mean, it's like I say, it's so weird to. It's something that we can, like, if there's a basic split in our perception, and our reality, so we're perceiving. I don't know how to finish this thought. As I say, you get to a certain point, and then it's like, it becomes, the danger is just oversimplification. But like the body that isn't occupied by the psyche becomes a container for poison. So all the impurity comes in, and all the rest of it, because the body isn't aligned with its psyche. It's not occupied. That idea seems to relate to this. But once the psyche is landed in the body, that's it. That's all there is. There's the body, the psyche as one thing in the natural environment, and that's it. I mean, nothing really needs to be done from that point. There's no king, there's no law, there's no lawmakers, there's no Jekyll, there's no Hyde. So, but that isn't a goal that can be socially implemented. That's just something that can happen at an individual level, and when it does, I think everything changes. I mean, I think the whole of existence changes, and it's over for that person in the best possible sense.
Yeah, I think that
Yeah.
drive, though, to return to a state like that is part of like human race's drive to annihilate itself. And then you see that in transhumanism and things, it almost seems like this, they want to create this perfectly self-aware body.
Okay, so but then it's the idea of returning to something, which I think is wrong, because the paradox or the mystery of this is that, well, I am talking about the psyche not landing in the body, so there is something that changes there, but it's not a return, it's something that got arrested that didn't happen. So it's really just that we've developed all these ways of doing that distort that way of being, that prevent that thing that needs to happen from happening. That seems to be all it is, and then once that thing that needs to happen happens, then it's happened, and it's not a return to something, it's completing something that was arrested. So I think that the whole desire to return to paradise, blah blah blah, that is the sublimated desire to go back to the womb, to get reimmersed in the mother's body, and that does manifest in, whether it's Nazism or Catholicism or Fabianism or whatever you pick your ideology, they all seem to have underlying this kind of primordial desire to get back to the lost state. And this is, yeah, that's never going to work. But the thing that does work can happen at any time, and I mean it is happening.
Sort of a
So
reconciling to that split nature.
a what?
Sort of reconciling yourself to that split.
I think it's, yeah, I think, but I think recognizing it is reconciling to it somehow. It's weird how that, it's like, if you see, like for me, I use my own example, like, the more I go into this stuff, the worse I feel, but the more I understand why I feel so bad, so the better I feel. And that's pretty much all that's happening. It's like, oh, this is why I feel so bad and why I've always felt so bad. So I start to appreciate the discomfort and the distress and think, oh, well, so that's how I've always felt. And now I can just contain it and just keep going. I'll just keep going, even though it makes me feel worse and worse. There's some very small signal that's getting stronger and stronger through that process. And that's the recognition of the split that allows for reconciliation with the split. And when the recognition, the reconciliation is complete, then there's no more split. Because, like, my experience and what I want from it is becomes one thing, and so I don't want anything from anything anymore. So that's it. The quest is over. Random Dude and I kept going for a second hour, which will be online the following Wednesday, the 7th of September. Random Dude does not have any links. He prefers to remain random, anonymous, undisclosed. This is Jason Horsley and The Liminalist, the podcast between. Yeah, that's it.